We've reached the realm of formless rapture now. This is chapter 21. And the Pali for this is the end of the heavenly realms section. So this is the last of these. And as I mentioned before, this is where all the Brahma lokas get sort of compressed into a sort of one heading. The original, or so the proper version of the original version of this in the sutta, you have a whole series of Brahma worlds named from the lowest all the way up to the highest. I think there's about 18 of them listed, and they're all just comprised, sort of compressed together to this, and all of them are comprised together under this one heading. So the Pali for this section reads, Brahma kaika deva saddhamanusave sum etam bhagavata bara nasiyam isipatane migadaye anuttarang dhamma chakang bhavatitang appativatiyang samanena va brahmanena va devena va marena va brahmana va kenachiva lokasminti. And the English for that is, the devas of the retinue of the Brahma deities took up the cry. At Varanasi, in the deer park at Isipatana, the matchless wheel of Dhamma has been set rolling by the Blessed One, not to be stopped by any Samana or Brahmin or Deva or Mara or Brahma or anyone in the world. And the painting that we have here is this great washes of mauve and purple and rose and crimson. The hands in the center are still in the Dhammacakka mudra. That's the mudra representing the turning of the wheel, and the spokes of the wheel have almost disappeared completely into the blazing light. And we have various deities on either side here with their hands in Anjali and various sort of wing-like auras and spouts of spiritual flame bursting out of their heads. The weaving of various patterns of light and form kind of swirling around, representing the Brahma Loka. And Ajahn Sujito will go into a bit more explanation about the sources of his imagery here. There's still a little bit of knotwork, the kind of Celtic knotwork motif is sort of plaited there in the edges of these deities. It's not sure whether it's their robes or their hair or just their their accoutrements of some kind, but otherwise there's no border, and there's no representing a lack of limit and the infinite quality of the Brahma world. So that when we chant the recollections of the four Brahmaviharas, Metta, Karuna, Mudita, Upeka, as the people will be familiar, then the words that we use to describe them are unbounded, immeasurable, you know, limitless, and that that quality of infinity and limitlessness is an aspect of these high Brahma worlds. By the time we reach this realm, we are at the Brahmakayika Deva Loka. The Brahmakayika Devas are the assembly of Devas who attend the Brahma deities. They occupy the first level of the next world, the world of the Brahma. The beings in the Brahma Loka have no sense desire and a form that is more refined than that of the six realms, so the ones below, like from all the rest of the Karmaloka, the sense desire realm. They also have a correspondingly long lifespan. They have attained this state of being through the development of absorptive meditation and loving kindness. The Brahmakayika Devas live in a state of devotion to what seems eternal and lofty. All of the Devatar experience happiness and bliss, but the higher the Devaloka, the more refined the object, as well as its resulting pleasure. Here, the object is formless, indefinite. In the realm of the Brahma gods, form is tenuous, yet these realms are also impermanent and subject to becoming and illusions of selfhood. This realm is equivalent to the mind that enters into a state of very steady happiness, born of faith without investigation. This happiness is an oceanic sense of oneness with, and trust in, the benevolence of the universe. Despite the fundamental goodness of this realm, it's subject to delusion. The mind goes to sleep. The object of one's faith, whether it be called God, the Tao, the Dhamma, the One, ultimate truth, is conceived in sufficiently remote and indefinable terms to be beyond investigation. It's beyond good and bad, or any other definition. This has an element of truth. Even awakened ones say that ultimate truth is beyond designations. With no ill effects at first, the mind can slip into attitudes that lack discernment. It's all Dhamma, we think, and we lose our sense of direction. As only the inclination to stay in a state of oneness and rapture for as long as possible and avoid the more abrasive energies of the sense realms. Yet the trials and pulls of the sense realms highlight the self-view and the liberation that is realized through abandoning it. Hence, the way of practice is outlined time and again in ways that are tangible. The Buddha kept his frames of reference linked to states that did not fascinate the mind or act as soporifics. And soporific means something that sends you to sleep. So if I get, if I start droning on and my reading of this text gets a little bit boring, then that's having a soporific effect. One of the things also to maybe mention is that the Brahma worlds are grouped, the first 12 of them are grouped in sets of three. So you have the retinue of Brahma, and then the ministers of Brahma, and then the realm of Brahma, and then you have the retinue of the next level of Brahma gods, and then the ministers of that realm, and then the Brahma gods of that realm. So there's four of those, and they four sets of three, and they correspond to the four jhanas, like first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. And so that there's a very direct correspondence between the kind of bliss that somebody in a deep state of absorption realizes and the experience of the Brahma realms. So that, again, just going on back to the theme that's come up a few times of how even though we're talking in terms of cosmology of other realms or different beings, there's a way that these map onto our inner life. And so then you have the lower Brahma realms representing the states of absorption, first, second, third, fourth jhana. And you also then have the formless jhanas, the arupa jhana, which the next higher levels of absorption, the arupa jhanas, and that they are realms of absorption, but without any kind of object. There's no form. So whereas the meditation is formless, arupa means without form. So similarly, those Brahma realms, the beings who are born in those realms, only have mind. They don't have any kind of form. They don't even have a subtle form. They're just mind only in those realms. And along the way, as I mentioned a day or two ago, you have these Sudavasa, the five realms where Anagamis get born. So they're up in the upper reaches of the Brahma Loka. And so it's said that in all of the different lifetimes of the Bodhisattva, and during the vastly long career of birth after birth, developing the ten paramitas, the only realms that after a being has made the Bodhisattva vow, the only realms that they're not born into is the five Sudavasa, those five pure abodes. Because kind of once you're born there, then the dynamics of it is that any being who's born in those realms will necessarily reach enlightenment in the relatively near future, and they can't be born in the human realm again, or the lower realms. And so that so even though a bodhisattva might be born in the formless Brahma realms, which are even higher, that they can reappear in the human realm. And it's also interesting that the Mahabrahma, which means like the great Brahma, who is a sort of Yahweh figure, the sort of Jehovah figure of the sort of Buddhist mythology, that Mahabrahma is only in the third level up of the Brahma worlds, and there's a time when the Buddha meets this Brahma god Bhaka, who is convinced that he's the creator of the universe. And the Buddha said, and when the Buddha is trying to teach this Brahma that he's not in fact the creator of the universe or the ultimate embodiment of all things, but he and when they have this interface with each other, the Buddha said, well, if you are really the supreme being, it will be possible for you to vanish from me, and so that I couldn't see you. And he said, yes, that's right. And then he tried to vanish, but he couldn't get away from the Buddha. And the Buddha said, but then if you were indeed that kind of supreme deity in all ways, then I wouldn't be able to vanish from your sight. And so that's right. And then the Buddha disappears and says, you can't see me, Brahma. Your realm only extends so far and no further. And then he says, and in fact, there's actually 18 Brahma realms higher than where you are. So not only are you not the creator and source of the universe, but there's actually 18 Brahma realms above you that you didn't even know existed. So it tries to set that Brahma straight in that way. And also you'll remember, or those of you who were here when I was talking about it before, that in amongst that, and I think it's at the highest of the, after you got to the sort of fourth jhana level of the Brahma worlds, there's a special little extra Brahma world called the Asanyasata Brahma realm, which is the realm of unconscious beings. And that's where if you have profound concentration based upon an aversion to the sense world, then that creates the karma of there's a negativity in there of a sort of fear or rejection or dismissal of the sense world. And so if that's a strong enough condition, then a being will be born in the Asanyasata Brahma realm, where you have a fantastically long lifespan and a glorious Brahma body, and live in a fantastically beautiful Brahma palace and this amazingly glorious infinite landscape, but you'll be totally unconscious for the entire 20,000 eons of your lifespan. So you sleep through the whole thing. So that unconsciousness is the karmic result of having rejected or resented the sense world. When the mind is also the kind of object that is used, or the basis for the rebirth in the Brahma realms, when we chant the Brahma Viharas, that means literally divine abidings, but also there are different meditation practices of entering into jhana where you can use those qualities of loving kindness or compassion or sympathetic joy or equanimity as ways of developing those profound states of concentration. So they're also said for creating the sublime abiding, or the Brahma Vihara, as an attitude of mind in the worldly sense. That can be an abiding, and that if that's developed and pursued to its fulfillment, then that will also lead to, say, rebirth in a Brahma world. So there's a time where the Buddha said that he was reborn as the Mahabrahma seven lifetimes in a row, I forget the exact number, but several lifetimes in a row, and then born as Indra 36 lifetimes in a row. And that was all on the basis of him having been a yogi, developing loving kindness. So he developed for a 7-year period as a meditator, as a yogi. He developed the absorption into metta, Brahma Vihara, and that resulted in sort of extremely strong karma of the mind being born into these bright realms. And so that's again, you can map that onto our own everyday experience. If you, when you meet people, or you're out on the M25, or you're in Waitrose, and rather than thinking, oh, these people, what crowds, or oh no, who have I got to work in the kitchen with today? Oh no, not her. Oh dear. Rather than the mind going towards its usual judgments and its preferences, to say, ah, look, So many people that I can spread loving kindness to. Fantastic. Traffic has ground to an absolute halt on the M25. Great. I can really focus on loving kindness to all these good beings that I'm sharing this road with. What a wonderful opportunity. And so when you direct your mind in that way and you relate to other beings as an opportunity to generate loving kindness and thoughts of benevolence, then you live in a bright world. You might not have a lifespan of 20,000 eons, but that's how we generate a bright world to live in, when your mind is, say, choosing that path of non-contention, and choosing the path acceptance and goodwill to all beings around you. So, the trials and pulls of the sense realms highlights the self of you and the liberation that is realized through abandoning it. Hence, the way of practice is outlined time and again in ways that are tangible. The Buddha kept his frames of reference linked to states that did not fascinate the mind or act as soporifics. And this is his advice to Mahaprajapati Gotami, the Buddha gave. But whatever are the states of which you, Gotami, may know, these states lead to passionlessness, not to passion. Absence of bondage, not to bondage. Absence of accumulation, not to accumulation. Leading to wanting little, not wanting much. Lead to contentment, not dissatisfaction. To solitude, not sociability. Putting forth energy, not to indolence. Ease in supporting oneself, not to difficulty in supporting oneself. You should know, Gotami, this is the Dhamma, this is the discipline, this is the teacher's instruction. Well, these were the words on Dhamma that the Buddha addressed to the first nun, Mahaprajapati Gotami, his stepmother and aunt. Applying this reflection within her practice, she also realized Nibbana. So she'd gone to the Buddha asking for some guidance in practice and saying, how do I know what is the Dhamma? How do I know what is not the Dhamma? What's the right thing to do? And then the Buddha gave her this series of 10 qualities that she could use as a measure of what's the right path. So just to go over those again. Whatever the states of which you know go to me, they lead to passionlessness, so to coolness of heart, not to passion. They lead to absence of bondage, so a lack of dependency, not to bondage. To absence of accumulation, so to living simply, not to accumulation. To wanting little, not wanting much, not being needy or dependent. To contentment, not to dissatisfaction. To solitude, so things that lead you to choosing to be alone or not to be caught up in socializing and chit-chat. Things that lead to putting forth of energy, to engagement and to alert attention to things. Not to indolence, not to being lazy. To ease in supporting oneself, not to difficulty in supporting oneself. So again, being one who is not needy or demanding or requiring a whole set of supportive conditions in order to feel comfortable or happy. And then he said, if something possesses these qualities, then you should know, Gotami, this is the Dhamma, this is the discipline, this is the teacher's instruction. But the Brahma deities have not realized Nibbana. The mind states that determine their existence lack insight and wisdom. Being too deeply absorbed in their own existence, they cannot reflect upon or know the way things are. And you'll remember again, if you were here when I was talking about it, there's a very interesting sutta where the Buddha talks about the application of reflective thought and investigation as different states of absorption are developed. And it goes through the first four jhanas and then the first three of the formless jhanas. So that they are, and then each one of those, he says, and then the mind should reflect. This is conditioned and thus gross. This is something that is formed, it's conditioned, it's dependent. This is impermanent and unsatisfactory. But there is that which is beyond it. There is the realization of nirvana, which is beyond these. And so that reflective mind can be brought to bear on all of those states, all the way up until the highest of the formless jhanas, which is called neither perception nor non-perception. And then the one beyond that, which is called the cessation of perception and feeling, which is Nirodha Samapatti. And so then when the Buddha is explaining that, he said those states are too refined for that reflective mind to be brought to bear on that. It's too so intensely focused and too bright that the reflective mind can't function at that level of intense focus. And so that, but right up until those last two, even within the realms of so infinite consciousness, in the realm of nothingness, or the realm of infinite space, then still that mind can be brought to bear and to say, well, even this infinite consciousness, even this realm of no thingness, this is impermanent, this is unsatisfactory, this is not self, but there is that which is beyond it. And so, at least in the meditation, that capacity of wisdom and the reflective mind can be brought to bear even in the presence of intense states of concentration, and the Buddha is encouraging that. And Ajahn Sucitto's comment here is saying that most Brahma deities don't even reflect that much, and that they are very absorbed in the sort of beauty and power and the bliss of their own experience, and so that the reflective mind doesn't often come into the picture. In Sutta number 11 of the Digha Nikaya, called the Kevada Sutta, a question arises in the mind of a meditating bhikkhu as to where the four elements cease. In other words, where is the place beyond all phenomena? He travels, presumably through psychic power, to various celestial realms and is continually advised to seek his answer in a higher abode. So, and the wording of that, and it's actually the wording of the sutta says the pathway to the gods appears before that bhikkhu. And then, so he first of all ascends to the realm of the Bhuma Devas, the earth spirits, and then the realm of the four great kings, and then to the Tavatimsa heaven, and Yama Devas, Tusita, and so on. And each one of them he asks the question, where is it that earth, water, fire, and wind cease without remainder? That's the question as he asks it. Where is it that the four elements come to an end and are no more, cease and come to an end and cease to be? And each one of them refers, and they say, well, this is very profound, we don't understand that kind of thing, you better go upstairs and check with the devas, and so that they send him up from the four great kings up to the Tavatimsa, then up to the Yama Devas, Tusita, and they keep saying, oh no, we don't understand that, that's profound philosophy, we don't know what the truth is, you better try up above. And so he gets referred all the way up as Lumpur Sumedha would describe, up the chain of command, up to the realm of the Brahma, Mahabrahma. And the retinue of Brahma and the ministers of Brahma similarly say, oh, we don't know, but the great Brahma is, great Brahma might possibly appear if you're patient and if you wait, and you can put that question to the great Brahma. So eventually he comes into the presence of the great Brahma, which is only the third of the 20 Brahma realms, but probably as high up as allows communication. However, the great Brahma, surrounded by devotees, can only respond to the question by extolling his own magnificence. He says, where is it that earth, water, fire, and wind fade out and cease to be? Where is it that they come to an end and cease without remainder? And then Mahabrahma says, I am Brahma, the great Brahma, the almighty, the orderer of all things, the wielder of mastery, lord and commander of all that are and are to be. In this very grandiose kind of like a Jehovah-like declaration, you get this: "I am the great one." I am the great one. And then the monk very politely says, "Well, thank you very much, but I didn't ask you that. What I asked was, where is it that earth, water, fire, and wind fade out and cease without remainder?" When questioned for the third time, the great Brahma takes the bhikkhu aside and says, "He doesn't know, but he can't admit that in the presence of the retinue." Like, and he says, "You're embarrassing me in front of my subjects, please. I don't know the answer, so stop making me look bad." The Brahma then admonishes the bhikkhu for seeking an answer to such a question from anyone but the Buddha. The Buddha, of course, puts the bhikkhu right by saying that the question should really be, where do the four elements not get established? So, where can they find no footing is another way of rendering it. Where can they not settle, or where do they find no sticking place? The answer is that they do not stick in the mind of someone who has no wish to attach to any mode of existence. When consciousness is in the rest state of cessation, the intentions and perceptions that define experience are not created. And this is one of Lumpo Sumedho's favorite passages in the Pali canon, which you people have probably heard him quote endlessly. And the English of it is, where consciousness is signless, boundless, all luminous, that's where earth, water, fire, and air find no footing. There both long and short, and small and great, fair and foul, their name and form are wholly destroyed. With the cessation of consciousness, this is all destroyed. And the Pali for that is Vinyanam Anidasanam Anantam Sabbato Pabang. And it's one of the very rare uses of the word vijnana, which means a transcendent quality of awareness or knowing, rather than a discriminative, separative consciousness of that discriminating this from that, and one thing from another, but rather it's referring to the fundamental quality of awakened awareness. That's what Brahmas don't know, because they're attached to their refined state of being. And Ajahn Sajito even blesses us with a drawing, his drawing of the great Brahma. Do please, it's not in the big hardback hand-drawn book, but it's in this Dawn of the Dhamma. So he did an illustration of the great Brahma here. It's kind of hard to describe, but you've got a large eye in the center and the Sanskrit symbol for Om. You've got a few hands reaching out into the void here with little handlets pouring forth from them. You've got great swirls of light and ribbons of something or other weaving around the edges. So it's a sort of, I think it's harking back to Ajahn Sajito's youth at Warwick University studying English and spending a lot of time illuminating his mind in various interesting ways. So it's a great imaginative splurge to come up with a drawing of the great Brahma. So if you take a look in that book, it's on page 153. Now, this is a very, very significant teaching. And again, even though it's in the realm of speaking about deities and visiting different realms of being, it's very pertinent advice for Dhamma practice, because that... what it is essentially talking about is that quality of awareness which provides no landing place for the sense world or for thoughts. It's like a mirror reflects light, but the light that is reflected in the mirror doesn't taint or color or spoil the mirror in any respect. The mirror just reflects the light and is unbothered by that. It just it's not affected by whether the object is beautiful or ugly, whether it's large or small. It just reflects in a completely open and unbiased way. And so that this Vijnanam Anidasanam that Lumpo Sumedho would so often talk about is the quality of awakened awareness which can know all things. It can know pleasure, it knows pain, it knows the pleasant, it knows the unpleasant, it knows the familiar, the unfamiliar. And that when that awareness is fully developed and is unbiased by greed, hatred, or delusion, then similarly it will know every experience without distortion and without identification. So it says giving no footing to long and short and coarse and fine and pure and impure. What then it also means is that it's not making any kind of absolute judgment, so that it's not choosing the pure over the impure, or it's not saying or looking at something as being intrinsically long or intrinsically short or intrinsically large or small, but just it receives all of those impressions, it knows them, but without any kind of attachment or identification. So that it's a very good way of describing that what we can call the Buddha mind, or the in Thai they use the expression the one who knows, or the puru, the quality of knowing itself, an unentangled knowing. And that these qualities of it, anidasana means invisible, dasati is the word to see or vision. So anidasana means non-manifest or invisible or without form. Vinyanang anidasanang anantang means limitless, infinite, without boundary. And then sabato pabang, sabato means all or everywhere, and paba is light, so luminous everywhere. As he translates it, this is Maurice Walsh's translation, as it translated as all luminous, or radiant in all directions. There's another interpretation of that word pabang, which refers to accessibility. So it's the word for a ford in a river where you can cross a river by foot. You sort of walk through the water. The water is very shallow, and so it has the in that sense it means accessible from every side. Completely, it can be forded from all directions. It can be crossed or entered from all directions. So in meditation, this is in a sense what vipassana is about developing, is that vinyanang anidasanang, that open heart, the open mind that's awake, that knows sounds outside or feelings in the body or thoughts in the mind or the different sense impressions, memories, ideas, plans, moods, emotions, and knows that these are just passing patterns of organic change, patterns of consciousness arising and passing away, and they're all and every one of them are anicca, dukkha, anatta, the unsatisfactory, impermanent, and not self. So that this is in a way describing the nature of mind when insight is fully developed, or the mind of the arahant. That there is, it gives, doesn't give a landing place or a footing, a place for those things or the thingness of an impression to be established, but the mind that knows this can only be a passing impression, a passing pattern of consciousness. That's what it is. There's also a very beautiful similar sutta where the Buddha uses the image of sunlight coming through the window of a house, and says, say that you're in a house with a window in the eastern wall, and the sun rises in the east. Sun comes through the wall, and then he says, where does if the sunlight comes through the window in the morning, where does it land? And then the person he's talking to says, well, if it comes through the window, then it lands on the floor. He says, if there's no floor, then where does it land? Well, it lands on the water. Well, if there's no water, then where does it land? Well, it doesn't land. In exactly the same way that this is the quality of unsupported consciousness, that there is there's not a place for it to land, no thing for it to be defined around. There's no illusion of a separate individual entity who is the experiencer, but there's simply seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, remembering, imagining, arising and passing away. And so that then in that that quality of non-entanglement or non-attachment, then there's a tremendous freedom. So that as he says, that quality is boundless, that it's unlimited. So Kevada Sutta, there's also another sutta in the Majjhima which is called an invitation to a Brahma, Brahma Nimantanika Sutta, and it's another one where the Buddha is meeting up with a Brahma god, and that same expression is used, vinyana is used in that same way, and there seem to be the only two places in the whole Pali canon where that expression is used, and vinyana is used in that way of a transcendent knowing. So it could be one of those passages that was somehow related to the mythology of Brahma gods, or was out of relates to another Vedic scripture that talked about the words of a Brahma or the qualities of a Brahma, because that's only used in relationship to the Buddha having these conversations or talking about Brahma gods. So Ajahnpasana's pet theory was that it was probably some kind of an expression from the Vedas or an old scripture that the Buddha knew of, and was, as he often did, he'd taking a teaching from another source and then tweaking it to convey his own insight and his own understanding. So I think it's probably enough from me for the part this first part today. So any questions, or there'll be anything useful to clarify on what I've been saying or from the readings? Yes.
Can I ask about Brahma's Hampati, who asked Buddha to teach? Because I heard different explanations of this fragment. Like one of them, that maybe it was added later because it's not in the Chinese Agamas. That's what I've heard. I haven't checked it. And the other one I've heard was his name Sahampati was the name of kind of disciple of the previous Buddha, to which this Buddha was a friend, and then he asked him to teach. I'm pretty interested in that fragment, and I'm interested in what could you say about it?
I'm surprised that you say it's not in the Agamas, because I know when, like, a city of 10,000 Buddhas, and there's monasteries of the Master Xuanhua's group, when they have a formal Dharma talk, then the way that the Dharma talk is requested is somebody takes a stick of incense and they walk three times around the shrine, and then they at the end of the third time, then, just as it describes in that request, they kneel down on their right knee and they bring their palms together and they repeat that same passage, but in Chinese. And so it was one of those things that I was particularly impressed. Like, oh, well, that's definitely the same, even with the physical gesture of kneeling down with the right knee on the ground and then that palms together, and saying please for the sake of those beings with a little dust in their eyes, you know, please teach the Dhamma. So I'd be surprised if it's not in the Agamas, because they didn't adopt that from the Pali. That was already the way they were doing it before having much connection with the Theravada tradition. I'm not sure of the exact mythology. I think that the Brahma Sahampati, I have heard that same story, that it was a bhikkhu, a being who was a bhikkhu in the lifetime of Kassapa Buddha, and has been reborn as in the Brahma world, and then that sort of special job is to make the request, you know, and the mission is when the next Buddha arrives, because you're going to have a very, very long lifespan, so that the next Buddha will come along quite soon in terms of your lifespan. So when he comes along and you pick up that thought from the next new Buddha, who will be Gautama, specializing in wisdom, when you pick up that thought that there's no point trying to teach the Dhamma because nobody will understand, your mission is to head straight down and make the request. So I have heard that story before. I couldn't tell you exactly where. But also there's the term Lord of the Universe, Brahma Chaloka Adhipati Sahampati. So that the title that Brahma Sahampati has is something like the Father God figure, like the Lord of the Universe. And so but it's a bit vague whether that means that Sahampati was from the Mahabrahma world or from a higher Brahma world. I've heard different interpretations of that, but that's the term is used, and so it works in with the mythology that the the Buddha's enlightenment is only completed because of the mother goddess, Dharani, being summoned forth to be his witness. The earth witness mudra is when he, after Mara is trying to attack him and dissuade him from enlightenment, then he calls forth Dharani, the earth goddess, to be his witness. And then, so his enlightenment is not, and his ability to be completely free of the assault of Mara is only completed because of the intervention or the arrival of the mother goddess. And then his role as a teacher only happens because of the influence of the father god, the creator god. So within the mythology, you've got those two elements that have to be there in order for him to be a Sammāsambuddha, fully enlightened by himself and teaching, ready to teach and to start a new sasana and a sangha. So that exactly how that all hangs together, there's various different renderings of that, but that just in the words that we use for the Brahmacaloka, that invitation for a Dhamma talk, that's the way that the Sahampati is referred to, is the Lord of the universe or the Lord of the world. Does that cover everything? Was there another bit in there that you asked about? Was there something else in there that you asked about? I've forgotten.
No.
Well, by the way, I should apologize. I did get that wrong about the iconography at Borobudur. I was getting it mixed up with the ancient stupa at Amravati in India, but Borobudur was 1,000 years after the stupa at Amravati. And so in the Amravati, you never get the Buddha represented in human form. So there, the Buddha is represented by a pair of footprints or by the Bodhi tree, or the space under the Bodhi tree, or by an empty chair. And I think even as a Bodhisattva, then you see him riding, well, you see the horse and somebody holding a parasol over the horse, but there's no rider on the horse. So that was in that era, that was before the Buddha was represented in human form. But then I took a look at some pictures from Borobudur, and the human form for the Buddha is used throughout that. So if you're editing these recordings, you can take that a little bit out.
I was surprised, yes, when I studied a little bit the radius of the Borobudur, that the narrative of the life of the Buddha finishes basically after his teachings, after the
Dhammacakka Sutta.
And then the whole development of the monks' order doesn't exist.
It is a bit strange. It's similar to Sir Edwin Arnold's Light of Asia. That in his that epic poem that was The Light of Asia, and it's very similar, whereby you have this long story of him growing up in the palace and then being motivated to leave the household life. 4 or 5 pages trying to tear himself away from Princess Yashodhara, and whether he should go, whether he should stay. And then the whole struggle for enlightenment, and then you get the enlightenment, and then you think, hang on a minute, there's not very many pages left in this book. And you get the enlightenment, and then the whole of his teaching career of 45 years is just in a couple of pages. And then the Parinibbana, and the dewdrop slips into the shining sea. So there seems to be some kind of pattern whereby that, I'm not sure why, it seems very strange to me, because you'd have thought his teaching career was the most important bit.
Well, I think it's a kind of different development of Buddhism, because then the next 12,
the next levels of the stupa, yeah.
So levels are full of variants of the spiritual seeker who eventually then visits all the different Brahma worlds and the future Buddhas and gets the highest teachings from the future Buddhas. So obviously way, you know, that aim for was not the Theravada way, but the kind of...
Oh, I see.
So obviously there, it's a different stage of the development of Buddhism, and it probably influenced by China, because Borobudur Ajava is lying on the Spice Road.
I think it was Vajrayana Buddhism that was very dominant in Indonesia at that time, and I think you're probably right then that it just the Four Noble Truths was taken as the preliminary teaching, and then you have these other Vajra teachings that are piled on top of that. So maybe the Light of Asia is a whole different story, but it comes out in a similar way that most of the attention is on the run up, and then you don't get the main body of teachings or the development of the sasana.
But it's a little bit disappointing when you visit that place and then suddenly, you know, it stops. I think there might be one or two areas of the passing away of the Buddha.
Yeah. I think so, yeah.